I'm Angela Davis, and every Sunday on this podcast, we're bringing you a selection of stories that are part of the NPR News North Star Journey series. If you're looking for more of this reporting on the history and culture of Minnesota communities, look for the North Star Journey link at nprnews.org. These stories are made possible in part by the Minnesota Legacy Amendments Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Coming up, you'll hear Hannah Yang's story about a special soup shared by Korean mothers and their daughters. NPR News contributor Melissa Olson also has a story about the federal government returning land to a Minnesota Indian tribe. But first, here's journalist Lee Hawkins on the profound impression substitute teacher Harold Bridgman had on him many years ago at Weaver Elementary School in Maplewood, a mostly white school. Hawkins started by asking Mr. Bridgman about the day they met.
Do you remember kids thinking that you were my dad?
I think some of the kids might have asked me, and I probably said, no, I'm the substitute teacher here. You're probably thinking about somebody else, you know. But I remember the day. The kids got along very well that day. And it was a very easy day for me. You know, I just followed the teacher's lesson plans, and we had an easy day.
Well, one of the reasons it was an easy day for you was because I wasn't the class clown that day.
Oh, okay.
You know, it was a very, very traumatic year for me. Being one of the only black kids in the school, there was a lot of racial bullying going on, and I was fighting every day. I told people I almost became a boxer.
Oh, really?
Because I was in the principal's office, and then, you know, the day that I came in and I saw you and saw that you were a black man, for some reason, it just, I knew right then, wow, I'm really going to do my best today.
Oh, okay.
And it also says a lot about the power of representation. When you were my substitute teacher, you were in law school.
Right.
Right? So you were sort of moonlighting and getting some extra, some extra income.
Right.
And then ultimately you became a psychologist?
Well, I was a psychologist then. I was a school psychologist then. And then I decided to go to law school because I thought this might be a little bit of a way of helping more people who are in trouble. I saw a lot of kids who were marginal in some of the schools that I taught. One of the years was in Chicago. Well, two of the years it was in Chicago. And I was at this all-black school in Chicago. One day I drove the school. I had this little Volkswagen. I drove the school and I left my lights on because it was dark. And I said, oh, God, I can't run out and turn my lights off. So I said, I asked one of the kids in my class, here are my keys. Go out and turn the lights out. Open my door and turn my lights out. From that day, the kid went down. He turned my lights on. From that day on, the kids watched my car like it was theirs. Nobody touched my car, and it was a tough neighborhood, too, so you were lucky if nobody didn't break into your car.
And when you became a teacher, you were one of the few black males, I would imagine, in most of the schools that you went to, right? Black male educators?
Well, if it was an all-black school like in Chicago,
yes.
Then, you know, there were a number of black teachers.
Okay.
If it was... I think in Gary, it was a mixed race school, so there was black and white teachers there. And then the second school I taught in Chicago, all the teachers were white, except me, you know. So that's how that kind of went.
We're in a situation now where 2% of the nation's teachers are black men. And there's a push.
2%?
Yeah, only 2%. There's a push in educational circles to add more to recruit and retain black males into the teaching profession. What are some of the challenges that keep black men out of the teaching profession?
I don't know.
What kept you from staying in the teaching profession?
Oh, I just wanted to, it just seemed like I could do more if I did something else.
Okay.
And I first thought I could do more as a school psychologist because of some of the kids I saw. Tended to have, you know, various problems of one type or another, especially in the all-black school I taught in. Some of the kids seemed to be very poor, and they seemed to you know, not have a lot of help at home and a lot of things like that. So I thought, well, you know, maybe I could help a little bit. And then I thought, oh, no, I'm not doing very much, you know. So I thought, hey, let me go into something else.
Are you surprised that only 2% of the nation's teachers are Black men?
I am. I didn't realize that. I thought by now, you know, you'd get, what's the Black population, 12-13% of the country's population?
About, yeah.
So I would assume it'd be that many in the classrooms.
You know, and I can't help but continue to ask myself, what was it about that day that made me not forget you? Now that I hear this story about what you did before you came to the school and that when I met you, I'm starting to think that it wasn't just because you were Black, but maybe also your experience in understanding students who might be going through trouble. Maybe I picked up on that that day, which, like, it seemed to you like this to be just another day at the office. But to me, it had a big, profound effect. Did you have any Black male teachers?
Let me think. I had a Black teacher when I got to graduate school and a Black teacher when I got to law school.
And what did that mean to you?
When I went to law school, we started out with about, I guess the entering class of law school was about 300 students. Of those 300 students, about 10 were Black, 8 or 10 were Black. Of those 8 or 10 Black students, only 2 made it to graduation day, me and one other guy, you know. But I felt good because this one Black teacher who was there in law school, he made me feel, hey, if he can make it, so can I. You know, I don't know how he did it, but he did it, so maybe I can make it. You know? So it's a positive influence if you have somebody that looks like you occasionally along the line. You know, that's very helpful.
Mr. Well, Bridgman, thank you, brother.
Thank
and I don't
you.
Mean just for doing the interview, but thank you for what you did for me and for so many others as an educator and a mental health professional. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. If I helped you in the least bit, I'm very happy.
God bless you, my brother.
Thank you very much.
Our next story comes from reporter Hannah Yang. She takes a walk down memory lane to remember a special Korean dish.
It's the weekend of my husband's birthday, and on the menu are his favorites, baked mac and cheese and yellow cake with fudge frosting. Aaron chooses these every year, but I always make a small pot of miyeokguk, seaweed soup.
Happy birthday!
First, I wash and soak the dehydrated seaweed in cold water. As a kid, I always wondered how the green slimy things you find in the ocean transformed into these crinkly strands. Now whenever I make it, the smells and the taste remind me of my omma, my mom, making Korean food for me. It's simple. Mostly seaweed with stew beef sautéed in sesame oil, soy sauce, and garlic. There's a secret ingredient my omma uses, and I think she'd get mad if I revealed what it was. But it's key to add it to give the soup that extra depth of flavor. She'd cook it for my birthday without fail. For my oppa, my older brother, and my appa, my dad too. Wow, that. 엄마 tells me after each birth, she would eat miyeokguk during postpartum recovery. My 할머니, my grandmother, made for her. There are health benefits to eating seaweed, which is rich in iron and vitamins. It's the epitome of home cooking, as my 엄마 calls it.
In Korea, starting from when you're in the hospital, from when the baby is born, you eat miyeokguk. So there was a point that for 1 month, I just ate seaweed soup.
Postpartum care is known as 산후조리. It's traditionally provided by the newborn mother's family members and in-law families. They'd cook healthy, warm foods and help care for the baby while the mother recovers. It was also important to keep the body warm. For Korean mothers, getting exposed to a cold breeze is taboo. Alma says it's because if a new mother fails to keep her body warm, it's believed she may become susceptible to a lifelong illness. When Alma gave birth at the hospital in the United States, she found a very different approach to postpartum recovery.
What surprised me was, there's this different culture. When I gave birth in an American hospital, I wanted to eat miyeokguk. So I was asking, can I eat something warm because I was feeling cold? But at the hospital, they gave me ice cream.
By eating miyeokguk on our birthday, we're reminded to thank our mothers by eating the same food they did postpartum. Alma says that my 할머니 took care of her after each birth, staying for almost a month until she recovered.
엄마들이 다 케어를 딸들을 해주는 거야.
All mothers care for their daughters. If they take off their socks, they put them back on. Even when they don't want to, they still put it back on for them. They clothe them in warm clothes. Otherwise, later, it'll get strenuous.
And they make birthday soup. My parents immigrated to the United States in the 1980s. They wanted to be sure my opa and I grew up speaking Korean in the house, and we ate Korean food for pretty much every meal. Alma says she was so happy that I learned how to cook.
Because if you didn't learn or didn't want to learn, then cooking Korean food could end with my generation.
I didn't marry a Korean, but Alma said she was so happy Aaron and his family love Korean food. She also loves that there are traditions we can pass down to our own kids someday. Mom, you're gonna come and make it for me, right?
Well, maybe. I don't know.
Now I'm here in my own kitchen. I'm cooking my Alma's soup for my husband in celebration of his birthday. He asked me to teach him how to make it so that he could make me miyeokguk on my birthday next winter. Because of my Alma, whenever I choose to have kids of my own, miyeokguk will be on the menu to remind them of me, just like I'm reminded of my own mother. Hannah Yang, NPR News.
And finally, NPR News contributor Melissa Olson brings us this story about the land that the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe will soon receive from the federal government.
The Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe is preparing to receive lands sold away from the tribe 7 decades ago. Leech Lake Tribal Chairman Farron Jackson told members of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs in 2018 why the land return mattered.
A robust land base is the foundation of tribal sovereignty and self-determination.
President Trump signed the Leech Lake Reservation Restoration Act into law in December of 2020. The act returns land within the Chippewa National Forest for the benefit of Leech Lake. The Bureau of Indian Affairs incorrectly believed it had the authority to sell tribal allotments without the consent of a majority of the rightful landowners. Leroy Fairbanks, representative for Leech Lake's District 3, says the U.S. government's practices of land transfers were acts of outright theft.
It was letters sent out for sales for allotments, and so my understanding was they mailed out letters to people. If they got a response, if they didn't get a response, they took them as yeses there. They took them as approval.
Thousands of acres of land were lost to Leech Lake before the Interior Department ended the sale of those allotments in 1959. Community members spoke out about the loss of land. Fairbanks, along with members of Leech Lake Reservation Business Council, have been lobbying Congress for the past several years. The Leech Lake Reservation Restoration Act adds 11,760 acres to the community's land base, all of it within the boundaries of Cass County. But years before the federal law changed, Leech Lake and Cass County signed a Memorandum of Understanding, a document outlining how the governments would communicate.
Humongous turning point for our relationship with the county.
Leech Lake and Cass County moved forward on a number of projects, from public works to law enforcement. When the issue of restoring land to Leech Lake did come up, Cass County was effectively neutral. Speaking on behalf of Commissioner Bob Kengis, Cass County Administrator Josh Stevenson explained Cass County's position with regard to return of the land was unique.
Because the county board respects the sovereignty of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, they passed a resolution that did not support or oppose the efforts of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. The county board's position was that Cass County and its board of commissioners should not get in the middle of negotiations between two sovereign nations.
Tim Sumner is a commissioner in nearby Beltrami County. He sees the work between Leech Lake and Cass County as an important step in building relationships between county and tribal governments across the state.
We can only anticipate that the relationships will be, you know, stronger.
Land ownership within the bounds of the reservation is a sort of patchwork. While Leech Lake maintains civil regulatory authority over the entire reservation, it owns just 5% of the reservation's original land base. The partial restoration of the reservation land base brings with it an opportunity to address some of the most pressing needs of Leech Lake citizens.
If we were to continue down 61st Street here, you'd hit the high school, middle school, Cass Lake Bina. So a lot of the families go to school here.
Ben Benoit is the environmental director for Leech Lake.
There's no additional room to put housing on this block.
He says an important part of correcting the historical injustice of land transfers is the restoration of land where people want to live today.
People want to live by where they work, by where their kids go to school, by the store. And that's, I think, what the tribe's been focused on, is trying to look at some of the planning we've already done in fitting this complicated question into those plans.
Leech Lake has submitted a plan detailing each of the parcels they would like returned from the Chippewa National Forest. Final approval of those maps is expected in the coming months. For NPR News, I'm Melissa Olson, Cass Lake.
You've been listening to stories from a new NPR News series that explores the history and the culture of Minnesota communities. It's called North Star Journey, and we'll bring you a selection of stories from the series each Sunday on this podcast. This reporting was made possible in part by the Minnesota Legacy Amendments Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more, look for the North Star Journey link at nprnews.org.